Hey guys, welcome to episode 4 of Pints and Puzzles. First, I want to thank you all for the flexibility with the production schedule here. I'm still aiming for every 2 weeks, but may have to ask for a little bit of wiggle room going forward due to new additions in the Pints and Puzzles family any day now. On that note, I did want to give a quick shout out to all of you that have stuck with me through these first few episodes. It's been a lot of work as a part-time hobby, but really a fun learning experience. And at the risk of sounding like a broken record, the support in all of its forms from both fans and fellow podcasters really is a major motivating factor for me. So thank you all very much. Tonight's episode is special to me in that not only is it one of my top three personal favorite UAP or unidentified aerial phenomena, it was also originally covered by Unsolved Mysteries, which was a major catalyst for my interest in these type of stories as a kid growing up. For the record, I'm talking Robert Stack era, and as much as I'd love to insert the theme music in the background here, we don't have the budget for those kind of royalties. So instead, I'm going to say, join me. Perhaps you may be able to help solve the mystery of the Kecksburg UFO.
What's a podcast? Find me a podcast. You're listening to Jim Esmond to my dad.
Traveling out to the Pittsburgh area has always been a bit of nostalgia for me. Yes, I love my Steelers and I love my Icy Light, believe it or not. Primarily due to the fact that my grandparents and 3/4 of my family growing up lives out that way. So needless to say, I've done this trip many times in my life. Little did I know, though, the events that occurred in a small town about an hour outside of my travels. It was December 1965 when residents from Canada to Michigan saw a giant fireball streak across the sky, appearing to have stopped in the woods near Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, which is located about an hour outside of Pittsburgh. Obviously, residents were curious and immediately went into the woods to investigate what many thought may have been a plane crash or possibly a meteor strike at that point. Sounds pretty familiar to our first case from Texas so far, right? However, this case does differ greatly in one major way. Within an hour of the alleged fireball flying through the sky, the military came in and took control of the situation. They cordoned off the area and made sure any looky-loos kept their distance. There was even reports of a couple teenagers being told to leave the area immediately at gunpoint, but more on that in a second. By the next morning, the object was taken away on a military flatbed, with its eventual destination being a sealed-off warehouse at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in neighboring Ohio. Strange thing here is, the military claimed to have found absolutely nothing. Eyewitnesses, on the other hand, seem to have a different story. While we're on the topic, one of the things that surprised me most in this case was the relative lack of eyewitnesses. Now, I realize the case is over 50 years old, so the eyewitnesses may be dwindling as the years go on, but I just found it interesting that an event this size, people didn't want to talk about it. Or was there more to their silence? One of the witnesses that we have heard from throughout the years is James Romansky. He was a volunteer fireman from a nearby town who was sent in to search the woods. Mr. Romansky described what he saw as one big, huge piece of metal buried in the mud. This thing had no rivets, no portals, no way to get in and out. And he also added that there was some hieroglyphics on the bottom of the craft. Obviously, it was inverted. Never miss a Top Gun reference. The general description of the craft was that it was 10 to 12 feet long acorn-shaped, and of course the strange writing on the bottom of it. This description will come into play more when we get into the theory section, but the interesting part of Romanski's story was that he said out of the dark, two guys with crew cuts and trench coats told him, "This area is quarantine. Get the hell out." Interestingly, Romanski was not the only one who had an encounter with government entities during this event. Local radio news director John Murphy was one of the first reporters on the scene and was able to compile a good amount of information on the crash throughout the years. Murphy did interviews with eyewitnesses and was even able to snap a few pictures of the object and had fairly in-depth coverage of the events. Murphy actually had enough information that he had a documentary set to air about the crash. Here's where things get a little more puzzling. Murphy was visited at his station by two men in black suits. The men confiscated some of Murphy's tapes and photographs and had a, quote, undisclosed meeting with him. Now, whatever this meeting was, the documentary called Object in the Woods did in fact air, but by all accounts was extremely watered down and had no mention of the alleged object. In a most likely unrelated event, Murphy was struck and killed by an unidentified car in an apparent hit and run while crossing the road on vacation in California a few years later. Okay, time to say it. This sounds strangely like a sighting of the Men in Black. Again, I really need a budget for royalties here. Other than being a chain of slightly above average movies, at least the first one was good and, you know, who doesn't love The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? Stereotypically, the Men in Black have a history of visiting and often intimidating witnesses and investigators into not discussing their extraterrestrial encounters in a similar fashion that seems to have occurred in this case. Mini history lesson time. The term Men in Black seems to have come about around 1953 when author Albert Bender closed down shop on his International Flying Saucer Bureau after a visit from, quote, people higher up. This in turn caused author Gary Baker to publish a book about Mr. Bender's experience. And this is where the term Men in Black was first officially used and described in more of the way we're used to hearing about it nowadays. Still with me here? Okay, good. These mysterious Men in Black have been described in a wide variety of ways, from pale-skinned, emotionless, and otherworldly, to your standard-issue government agents. If you want to see a pretty convincing example of this, go onto YouTube and look up The Real Men in Black Caught on Tape. Now, this video combines some hotel security footage with an interview with the hotel manager, and it's really creepy and fairly well put together. And if you're interested in a more in-depth explanation, I'd recommend Astonishing Legends' four-part Mothman series, as the Men in Black played a significant role in the Mothman case as well. For those of you that want even more information, well, I'm going to ask you to look at this little red light here. And it was swamp gas. As great as this story is, the Kecksburg crash didn't really land in the mainstream radar until it was covered in the early 90s on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. Since then, all the players you would expect have come out to play. We have Discovery Channel, Sci-Fi, UFO Hunters, and yes, even Ancient Aliens have had their theories and their own little spin on the story. Sci-Fi specifically seems to have taken this case very personally with their own investigation into this, as well as a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, which was filed in 2005. Spoiler alert here, the short version is there was a lot of back and forth, which is no surprise given you're trying to get documents from the government. Probably not surprising, there was no information of value found at NASA in their files. Leslie Keene from Sci-Fi and the originator of the lawsuit had a long list of conclusions, which, quite honestly, I won't bore you with, but basically boils down to disorganization in filing and misplacing files on NASA's part. What I would ask is, was that disorganization coincidental, or more deliberate. As you can probably see, or hear, by just this one example, the theories run the gamut in this case. So keep your tinfoil hats nearby, get a refill of your beverage of choice, and we're going to take a quick break from our sponsor. I know most of you are like me and love supporting small and independent businesses. As such, by supporting our ongoing sponsor, Fulton for Life, you are supporting an awesome small business and, of course, one of your favorite independent podcasts. And we all know, happy wife, happy life, right? So head on over to fultonforlife.com for all of your holiday shopping. Extra 10% off with my promo code PINTS at checkout. Short of a few extreme skeptics, I think most people that have looked into the Kecksburg case would agree that something crashed in the woods. Let's walk through a couple of the more popular theories. A little behind-the-scenes peek here at Pints and Puzzles. Oftentimes when I find a topic for the show, believe it or not, I'll actually go to a more skeptical website first to start my research. Despite the snarkiness of a few of them out there, there's typically at least a logical argument behind a lot of the quote-unquote skeptics' point of view. In this case, the skeptics' claim is that there was depth perception issues and people actually weren't sure where or when they saw the object actually come down. I'll be the first to concede that depth perception issues are an absolute reality. There's scientific evidence behind that. And hey, this theory is actually more in line with the official Air Force explanation as well, being a meteor crash. Or should I say this was the Air Force's second official explanation? Remember they originally claimed to have found nothing at the site? One of the more shocking things in this case is the theory of an otherworldly craft seems to be relatively low on the theories list. Despite the heavy military presence, I haven't read any tangential reports about any alien bodies or aliens or any of those things that you hear about. Personally, I think this is due to the fact that the object didn't exhibit any of the typical alien craft behaviors. So it had more of a slow descent, crash into the woods. And based on witnesses' descriptions, it didn't appear to have any portals or any other way for any living object to get in or out of the craft. Though the object was not likely alien as such, one of the more popular theories is just as far out there. Remember earlier when I said keep your tinfoil hats nearby? Now might be a good time to put them on. During World War II, the Germans were widely known to have been experimenting with many types of advanced technology. I mean, heck, we ended up using a handful of these scientists in our own space program through Operation Paperclip. One of the devices allegedly worked on was known as Die Glocke, or the bell. Being completely transparent with y'all, this is a hard topic that falls squarely into the conspiracy theory realm. As such, though, I did put a link to the Wikipedia page in the show notes, but here's my interpretation of what I've learned about the bell throughout my years of researching this genre. Basically, this was a large bell-shaped device that worked with a special compound called Serum 525, or red mercury, depending on which source you read, placed in two giant spheres that rotated counter to each other at massive speeds. I'm not sure what their intent was here, whether it was a flying ship, advanced nuclear weapon, or straight-up time machine, as some have speculated. Now, bear with me a minute here. I personally think that experiments like this could mess with the electromagnetic fields and cause a rip or portal to occur. The bell very well could have been sucked into such a portal and dropped into the Kecksburg woods in 1965. Sounds out there? Absolutely. However, look up the Philadelphia experiment. There was a similar experiment done with attempts at stealth technology and Navy ships. As with the bell, there seem to be massive levels of electromagnetics involved here, resulting in what some claim to be a similar transportation or teleportation of the ship itself. Reality is, everything basically boils down to electricity, so I don't see any of that as being really that far-fetched. Now, before my buddy Chris over at the Mad Scientist podcast head explodes, I'll leave the science to the scientists here. Now that we've gone down a couple of the rabbit holes here in this case, let's pull back up and take a look at probably the most commonly accepted explanation for the Kecksburg crash: satellites. In December of 2005, just before the 40th anniversary of the Kecksburg crash, NASA claimed the debris collected in Kecksburg was from a, quote, re-entering Russian satellite. Now, for the record, this is the third change in the official story here. Nonetheless, there was in fact a Russian Cosmos 96 craft re-entering the atmosphere on the same day that the Kecksburg crash happened. According to NASA, the Russians would essentially have a launch craft in Earth orbit, which would then point the probe in the right direction and then launch it. So the theory here is this: the probe misfired and broke apart in the Earth's atmosphere, which is what people saw as fireballs, and the acorn piece was just a part of the satellite after it broke apart. Only catch is, many people seem to think the satellite re-entered Canadian airspace 12 hours prior to the Kecksburg crash. Okay, I was able to get through that last segment without any inappropriate jokes, so bravo to me. The last and most explored theory is the object that crashed was actually a top-secret American satellite named the GE Mark II. General consensus seems to be the Mark II was designed to capture images of either other satellites or other earthly going-ons, as we'll say. Either way, it was designed to hold film in it and come back down to Earth. Even though the shape of the re-entry vehicle is slightly off, the logistics surrounding it seem to make logical sense to me, at least. If it was a classified satellite, then of course the military and government would be all over it and unwilling to confirm anything either way. And to top things off, the Mark II was also rumored to be nuclear-powered, which would also explain the rush to get it out of a populated area and into a secured military bunker. So now we're at everyone's favorite time of the show, my take on what happened in Kecksburg. I personally think it's safe to rule out extraterrestrials in this case, and a satellite of some sort seems to make the most sense. But I also wouldn't rule out the Bell theory either, as far out there as it sounds. To me, the biggest flag for something secretive happening is the, quote, lost footage from NASA. Now, I agree, this could just be sloppy work or disorganization. However, the other notoriously lost footage is the original Apollo 11 tapes, which there's speculation that the crew may have caught more than they should have on the moon, but I digress. In this case, though, I'm going to leave it up to Stan Gordon, who, in my opinion, is an expert on this particular incident. And he said, whatever came down in Kecksburg that night is of high importance to the military agency. The most mysterious thing about the whole case is the fact that after 25 years, the government still refuses to give us any actual information on what occurred. Well, I think that's going to wrap up my interpretation of what I think happened in the woods of Kecksburg on December 9th of 1965. As a more mainstream case, there's probably going to be some more opinions out there than my previous cases. Just for the record, I'm always up for discussion. Just keep it respectful and I'll do the same back to you. You can always hit me up on the Twitters at Pints and Puzzles, and my email is pintsandpuzzlespod@gmail.com. Now, before I let you non-beer review people go for the evening, I did want to let you all know that there's a really cool Indiegogo campaign that was recently brought to my attention by the guys over at Breweries in PA. Of all the Hall of Fames out there, there's surprisingly not a beer Hall of Fame yet. One group in Pittsburgh wants to change that. If you head on over to brewmuseum.com, on their site you'll also find information for their Indiegogo fundraising campaign if you're interested in contributing to that in any way, shape, or form. For the record, this campaign is not connected to Pints and Puzzles in any way officially, but I do appreciate you all checking it out as it seems like a really cool concept from my perspective. Tonight's beer review is on the way, and I will talk to you all in 2 weeks, with the caveat of unless we have a new member of the Pints and Puzzles family by then the schedule may change, but I'll keep you all posted on social media and through this feed as well too. Our beer review is coming up. Otherwise, for those of you in the United States, have a happy and safe Thanksgiving holiday. Take care, guys. Tonight's beer is our first listener-submitted beer. One of my loyal local listeners was awesome enough to hook me up with a growler from Spoonwood Brewing out in the Pittsburgh suburbs, which I thought was appropriate for our episode this evening. All right. Yeah. It was my dad. But still, he's still a loyal listener, and it doesn't make it any less awesome. So thank you, Pops, for the growler. I appreciate it. So the beer being featured is Spoonwood's Killer Diller IPA. As most of you probably know, I'm fairly new to the IPA side of craft beers, but this is a nicely balanced IPA with just a little bit of bitter in there, but it's not super hoppy. I actually noticed less citrus with this one, and it turns out from looking at their website that they actually don't use Cascade hops, which are found in many of the IPAs and pale ales that I've tried so far, so that was actually a fun learning experience that I could pick that up. Beyond this initial beer tasting, I was able to glance through Spoonwood's website, and they have some pretty cool standard beers, as well as some creative ones out there, including Working Class Hero is brewed with ginger and green tea, which sounds right up my alley, as well as one called Secret Alphabet that's brewed with habanero and serrano peppers, so that'll give you spice lovers out there a nice little charge. So clearly I know where I'm going on my next trip out to Steelers country, and there's also a nice menu out there, so I could also bring my wife and kids there, which is always an added bonus. I think that'll do it for this evening, so drive safe for those of you traveling for the holidays. Otherwise, I will talk to you soon. Good night.
That was pretty awesome. That was totes amazing. Growlers. That's really great.